Nurses and Hypochondriacs, the podcast that brings nurse experts, patients, and hypochondriacs together to discuss hot topics in healthcare. And here is your host, Ercilia Pompilio.
Welcome, nurses and hypochondriacs. Here we are again for another episode. I'm really excited about this episode today. A lot of people have been asking me to do it on this subject matter, narcissism. It seems like they're everywhere these days, and I live in Los Angeles, the capital of narcissism. So today we have on our special guest. Her name is Dr. Ramani Durvasula, and she makes psychology useful and usable for a wide variety of audiences. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and a professor of psychology at Cal State LA. And she wrote this amazing book. It's called Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. She's also published other books and done extensive research on the subject matter. Welcome, Dr. Ramani.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for agreeing to be on. So let's go ahead and start. When I read your book this weekend, I really enjoyed it because I've been on this journey to figure out myself and about my own narcissistic past. My parents were narcissists. This is what I found out. 2013, I started having a lot of problems, and I started to look at my life. Started to look at my work relationships and my personal relationships. And I started on this journey. I wish I had your book in 2013. It would have made it so much simple. But when I opened up your book and I started reading about Mad Men, like you open it up with Mad Men and Don Draper. The funny thing is I used to have this vision board and I had a picture of Don Draper on my vision board, which is John Hamm. He's the actor who plays John Don Draper. And I never had watched the series. So then I watched the series. I was like, oh, let me check this out. And I immediately went and ripped the picture up to shreds and threw it away.
Mark, and I would say, that's exactly right. And that's exactly the issue. The Don Drapers of the world get the girl, but they're the last person you'd ever want to be in a relationship with. And yet they're charming, they're charismatic, they're successful, they're handsome, they're well put together. That's what every little fairy tale that every girl, in fact, every boy, you know, has been given to go for that person. And I'm telling people to go for the opposite, because the problem is once you get into a relationship with a narcissist, the longer you stay and the more of a life you build with them, the more it's going to be a problem that lasts for the rest of your life. I liken narcissists, in fact, to cigarettes. They're never good for you. There's probably not even one cigarette is safe, but you don't want to become a long-term smoker because you're going to get sick and die. It's the same thing with narcissism. You don't want to get into a long-term relationship with them because you're going to get sick and it would probably actually be really bad for your health.
I love that analogy with the cigarettes. It's excellent.
Yeah.
Let's get into why did you write this book and how, how did you come up with the idea? Why did you think it was needed? And what I think also is very interesting that you put in the book is the fact that this is not a book that your colleagues would have wanted you to write, or it's not acceptable in the professional area.
No. Well, I mean, I got inspired to write the book because of a couple of things. Some of the research I was doing on personality disorders at the university I was working on, and we were specifically looking at the relationship between personality disorders and health. And a lot of people with these kinds of patterns often do unhealthy things, including have unsafe sex and putting them at risk for HIV. So I was doing that research as an academic. But at the same time in my clinical practice, I was seeing more and more people come in and they were basically saying the same story. And what they were doing each and every time was describing a narcissistic partner. And, you know, in order to sort of recap our sessions, we'd sometimes take notes. I'd even send them emails saying, you know, think about this, think about that. And I started seeing the emails started looking increasingly similar and I was getting tired of writing the emails. And I thought, well, this all should be in a book. And so I put it all into a book on this particular issue. My life has been touched by narcissism too, via relationships and family stuff and all of that. So it became personal and I became devastated at watching so much unrealized potential in people who were sort of almost imprisoned by these relationships and had lost their voice and lost their sense of potential and the hopelessness and the helplessness. They are basically, the narcissists had kind of stolen their voice and stolen their lives and resulted in this person living in fear and insecurity. I thought, this has to end. And so that's where the book came from. It was really my hope that, and I also recognized though that for a lot of people, leaving is not an option. And I think it was very important for me as a psychologist to be respectful of that. I can't tell everyone, you're in a relationship with a narcissist, pack up and leave. That's not always an option. Reasons of children, money, culture, practicality. Some people can think they're in love with the person, and I don't get to question that. Whatever the reasons are, they don't want to leave the relationship. But I wanted to give them a realistic template for what it means to continue having a relationship with this person and let them know that the relationship is never going to change, that person is never going to change. So this is it. Either you take it or leave it, but don't expect it to be different.
And I think you bring that point home really great in the book where this relationship isn't going to change. And I've had friends, you know, with me, I've noticed that. I mean, I was in a relationship that was like that. And after that relationship, after my marriage, I started noticing I was attracting the same relationship, and it felt like Groundhog's Day. It was like almost the same wordings. It was weird. It was like, do the narcissists all get a script? I mean, it was the same wordings. It was the same love bombs. It's like, oh my God, you're so beautiful. You're so talented. You're so smart, and you have everything going for you. You know, you're a triple threat. And of course, everybody likes to be told those things, especially if you come from a family that doesn't give you that emotional.
Right.
And so it's very alluring. Now, can you make the distinction between the DSM-5 criteria? So you go through that in the book right from the start, and what narcissism is and what the, you know, sociopathic mentality is as well.
So the trick, and again, knowing that a lot of your audience is healthcare professionals too,
right,
that when we use the DSM, or what we call the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, that's just sort of a manual that lays out all the criteria for various mental illnesses. Narcissistic personality disorder is in there. And it's made up of a sort of series of 9 kinds of traits. And if a person has 5 of them, and it's a consistent pattern for them, and this is the big and it's causing them social and occupational impairments, then we diagnose it. If you look at the work of this guy named Alan Francis, and Alan Francis is a older senior scholar who's actually one of the people who wrote this diagnostic criteria a long time ago. And even he will come out and say, listen, this is not, you don't get to diagnose someone for being a jerk. You know, if they're a jerk, they're a jerk. And if they're not aware they're a jerk and their jerkiness is not causing them any problems, you don't diagnose it. You know, you can't diagnose someone because they're making other people miserable. So I think where it gets confusing is you have this diagnosis that really the prevalence rates aren't that high, probably somewhere between 3% and 6%. And yet everyone out there knows someone. So that doesn't add up. It's because the people they know probably don't have narcissistic personality disorder. And frankly, it's irrelevant. They have a pattern called narcissism. And if you really think about what narcissism is, it's a fancy word for pathological insecurity. These are the most insecure people in the room. And because they're so morbidly insecure, in essence, they take it out on the world. You know, it's like they're like vampires. They're vampires. They suck other people's security and they make it their own. And so that's really the pattern we're talking about. And so that's when I laid out in Should I Stay or Should I Go? And I'm actually working on a third book now that hopefully comes out early 2019 is the goal, is that I really lay out, there's probably about 30 to 35 things that you see in narcissistic people, and they kind of fall into 5 categories. And if you have enough of them, I don't care if you have a diagnosis or not, you're a jerk and you're a horrible person to be with. And so, and I tell people, if you sense someone's like this, don't give them a second chance. Don't forgive them. Distance, distance, distance. I don't care if it's your mother. I don't care if it's your father. I don't care if it's your husband. I don't care if it's your boss or your friend. It's going to play out the same way every time.
It does. It does. I mean, something that was going on for me when I started waking up, and it was back in 2013, I felt myself going from job to job to job, and I was having these same types of people. They would allure me with, oh, we could use your talent here. We need someone like you here. We need the cheerleader. We need someone to boost morale. And I remember having three jobs in a row that was like that. And it was weird. And it was almost like these people were feeding me a script. And each job I had to, like, there was just extreme chaos going on there. And so now mm-hmm. I've learned every time someone says that to me, I just had a job interview, probably in September, where the recruiter told me the same, like he was reading the same script. And it was like, oh my God. And so I said, absolutely not. Mm-hmm.
So good. And that's what it is. You might get smart. You might get smart to it then, right?
Right. Because it's the same lingo though. And it was just like, is it just my subconscious mind that is being trained to this or that wants this, you know, because of course nurses, you know, we're the healers, we're the empaths, we're there. We want to save the day. I mean, that's, we're taught that in school, that it's not about us. It's about other people. And you kind of, I mean, your brain gets really set on that, but you do talk about that in the book, and that is the that savior mentality, right? That these narcissists will latch onto, and they'll bring you in.
Oh, they absolutely do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, because you're an easy target, right? So let me go back to the original question you'd asked, like, what is narcissism?
Yes.
I often tell people there's sort of central pillars to it, and the central pillars of narcissism are a lack of empathy. Being chronically validation seeking, being very superficial, being grandiose, being deeply entitled, being arrogant, and being prone to rage. Those tend to be sort of the central pieces of this, but there are lots of other things. They tend to lie a lot. They're very jealous. They are envy other people. They're very covetous. They want to look great on social media, and then they treat people horribly. You know, so there's subtypes of narcissism too. It doesn't always look the same. There are your traditional sort of grandiose, mean narcissist. That's usually what we think of, and that's what we see more in the media. But then there are what we call covert narcissists, and those are the narcissists who go around and they're not very nice people, and it's always, but they seem depressed. It's like, woe is me.
Yes.
My life's never going to be any good. And why doesn't anyone
Eeyore.
See how great I am? I'm so great. It's Eeyore. But Eeyore never walked around saying how great he was. You know, they're like Eeyore, but they don't walk around saying, I guess the world isn't smart enough to see what a great guy I am. And someday they're going to come around and see how great I am. And boy, will they be sorry, because by then I would have moved on to better things. That's the covert narcissist, you know, because they never quite make it. And because they don't make it, they don't have anything propping up their grandiosity. So it's a whole woe is me dialogue, but that's because the world doesn't know how great I am, you know? And so there's all these subtypes. And then you would also raise the issue of what's the difference between narcissism and a very popular word out there called sociopathy. Sociopathy and psychopathy are very related. The difference is, and they tend to be used and misused, is that all sociopaths and all psychopaths are narcissistic, but not all narcissists are psychopathic or sociopathic, if that makes sense. So all psychopaths and sociopaths, they're entitled and grandiose and they lack empathy and da, 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 da. The big difference is the psychopaths and the sociopaths have no remorse. So a narcissist actually might feel bad or guilty after they do something bad. They'll keep doing it, but they may actually have a moment where, like, oh, that wasn't very nice. The psychopath, the sociopath doesn't even feel that. And so that makes them more dangerous because they don't even think about or care about the consequences that will come. And so I think that a lot of times the words are all used interchangeably, but that's really the ringer. I think that the psychopaths and the sociopaths are more likely to exploit other people, mm-hmm. take really awful advantage of them, probably definitely more likely to be violent, those sorts wow. of things. So it's definitely a more dangerous spin on it. That's not to say narcissists can't be violent though. So that's what I'm saying. It sort of is almost like a continuum. And you know this in nursing, is that, you know, it's like anything, there's more and less severe variants of things. There's less severe narcissists. There's people out there who just really are full of themselves, but they're not really bad people.
Right.
But they'd never be someone you'd want to take a personal problem to. So, you know, there's that piece. Then you brought up the issue. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. But there's always just people that are the narcissists, and you know you just can't trust them. There's just something about them.
Right.
That you're like, mm-hmm. I would not tell this person my personal secrets, because you know they
right.
will destroy
right.
you. You know, whether it's subconscious you know, I had this issue where someone I went to school with, and that was about 15 years ago, and in grad school, and I had heard rumors that she was going around and telling people that, oh, my storytelling show wasn't HIPAA appropriate, or my podcast wasn't this, wasn't that. And I was just like, who cares? I was like, why is she even talking about it? and why is this even getting to me? But it's very interesting, so certain people like that. But you were saying, I cut you off.
Yeah, but then you were talking about being in the world of nursing and this idea of, nurses are socialized, trained, and probably were before they even went to school, caregivers. They're empathic. Right. They want to take care of people. And does that make them a more likely target for a narcissist? Possibly. I think that anybody who is very empathic, who's all about second chances, let's give everyone a chance, maybe we heard that wrong. That is actually, sadly, that's how women are socialized. That is how many helping professions are socialized. And that's how people get themselves into a heap of trouble. I wish people would trust their guts if they meet someone and they're like, yeah, I found that person a little off-putting.
Yes.
You may not want to go in for an act two. You know what? The worst case of scenario is every time sometimes you may end up missing out an opportunity to meet someone who is just a little insecure and they might've been a nice person. But frankly, everyone in the world is destined to meet twice. So maybe the second time you might meet other people say no, yet you must have misread that, or they're very shy and you misread that. That might possibly happen. But most people get it. And I'll tell you, some people, we talk about things like gaydar and all that. I have narcissist radar. And I will be frank with you. When I experience it, I've been known to leave dinner parties in the middle of the main course.
I have done that.
I'll be like,
too.
You know what?
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And you have to. Because people will often, and I'll say, and I'll very gently go to the host and say, I got to run. Something's come up.
Yeah.
Who's going to question that? Then later on, sometimes the host or hostess will call and say, what happened? And I'll explain to them. And sometimes people have been insulted by that, to which I'm saying, okay, then let's put you out too. It's amazing how much time people spend decluttering their homes of stuff. I'm a big fan of decluttering your home, your life of people. Somebody
yes.
is not making
yes.
you grow. They need
I
to
agree.
Go. They need to go.
Well, I have a good story yeah. about this to share. In 2015, there was this big literary party at the Ace Hotel. And everybody who was anybody in the Los Angeles literary world was there. And I had a friend at the time who was an editor for a publishing house. And so he was going, I went, I was just getting into writing, starting to get articles published. So I was very excited. And there was about 600 people there. So my question was, it was open bar. It was a fabulous party. And the who's who of the Los Angeles literati were there. And my question was, who's hosting this party? Who put this on? Who's paying for this? That was my first question. And it was this woman, and her name was Anna Marsh. And I was like,
yeah, there was a whole story in the LA
exactly,
Times. There's actually, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. There's a whole mm-hmm. big story about her. And I was like, really? Her? Something is bugging me about her. Who is she? And nobody mm-hmm. knew who she mm-hmm. was. And I went to my friend who's the editor, and I was like, who is she? Do you know her? And he's like, no. Like, he didn't know her. I mean, he knew just about everyone. And I was like, something's not right here. And it was sad because the woman in San Diego in that article that she took advantage of, this woman started a nonprofit and she took advantage of her. I had taken classes from that woman and she was the nicest woman. I was like, I can't believe this article. This is so disgusting. Like people were just going and people were like, well, it's a free party, and nobody questioned it. And where was this money
right.
coming from? Cause it was a pretty
right.
elaborate party. It was three stories of the Ace Hotel and mm-hmm. Free drinks. And, so it was that's a classic example of that. But my mm-hmm. Radar goes off. And I even had many years ago when I first started in my nursing profession, there was a man who was a respiratory therapist who I kept saying, this guy is weird. Something's not right with him. And people are like, oh, what are you talking about? You're wrong. And he ended up being the angel of death. And it was a mass scandal at Glendale Adventist Hospital where they had to exhume bodies. And it was just ridiculous. I didn't work in conjunction
right.
with him, but he would come to our mm-hmm. unit and stuff. So I do have that too. And it's always the trust your gut, trust your intuition, which a lot of people discount.
Right. No. So. Well, it's not, it's a trust your gut, but it's also be real with yourself. You know, I always say that the reason old, you know, haggard, narcissistic guys are able to keep attracting people around them is because they often have a lot of money and they have the nice right. house on the beach in Malibu and everybody wants to go to their party. And I'm like, that's a hell of a price of admission. I'd rather go park in the lot with everyone else, put my own damn towel down than have to sort of worship at the altar of the narcissist. So I think people don't want to question. They don't want to know what the sausage is made of. Ask questions. And if it doesn't feel good, be authentic and step away.
Yes. And you bring up that point. There is a price of admission. I mean, like the cult leaders, I just went to a podcast event for 30 for 30 where they had the Bikram yoga guy. And they mm-hmm. were talking about him and what he had done. And so I asked a question because there are still Bikram yoga studios being opened up today. And right. I was like, it's kind of a question of ethics. Why would anybody still keep opening
that's
it up?
Right. I totally agree. You know? I totally agree.
I go, this is disgusting. And the woman there was like, well, because she had managed a Bikram studio. She's like, it's such a great yoga and people really like it. It's such a moneymaker. No, it's not. And then I talked to her. I talked to her sidebar. I know it's a moneymaker. I talked to her sidebar and she was telling me the science of it and how many people got dislocated hips and this and that. And I go, why didn't you talk about that in your podcast? Because that's very relevant, you know, because you're saying that this is such a healthy yoga and it's really not. And she's like, oh, well, we didn't find a space for it. Like,
yeah, you know, and I don't, I think that it's less about, you know, but I think when it comes down to the narcissism issue, it is that idea that people will write excuses for them because listen, we all have a little bit of an exploitative and manipulative edge, right? Like maybe this is where how the Harvey Weinstein thing went down.
Yes.
Everybody knew what was going on. Most people remained silent either because they were scared he would screw over their career, which he probably would have, or they knew exactly what he was doing, but they thought, let me just ride this wave long enough to get to get myself sorted out. You know what? You're the one who has to live with yourself when you make that call. That's it.
Exactly. And I totally agree. It's, you know, and I was in a situation in a hospital setting where I was working for a pediatric neurologist and he sold me just everything under the sun. And it was when I went in there, it was nothing to the degree. He was doing a lot of gaslighting. At the time, I didn't know what the term was. And I was going to a hypnotherapist to get therapy and just to change my behaviors and stuff. And I had been doing triathlons as well at that time. So it was kind of helping me with focus. And so, you know, she brought up the term, sounds like this guy is gaslighting you, because I asked him, well, what are you doing on the 4th of July? He's like, I'm going to a conference. I go, what kind of a conference? Fireworks conference? And he's like, no, you know, a psychology or some conference, some neurology conference. And I was like, oh, okay. So I ended up going on the 4th of July for a bike ride at the LA River. And I happened to run into his director from pediatric neurology from when he was a resident who happened to work at my former hospital. And I was like, hey, aren't you at this conference? And she's like, what are you talking about? And I knew he was full of shit, you know? And so then I started to know, like, everything this guy is telling me is a lie. So, and I immediately quit that job because it was dangerous. So, you know, it's, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about the term gaslighting and what these people will mm-hmm. do just to keep the facade going?
Well, gaslighting is considered to be a form of emotional abuse. And it is thought that because basically it is denying or doubting the reality of another person, really with the goal of throwing them off balance. So in other words, classic gaslighting lines are things like, that never happened. I never said that. You're acting crazy. That's not true. When things are clearly, I mean, instead of hearing it out or owning it. And so a person can really literally feel like they're losing their mind. There's also, when we're thinking about gaslighting, there's also other kinds of patterns, such as they're, they can be very withholding. So like, in other words, I'm not going to talk to you if you say you bring that up again. So in other words, they're sort of silencing the reality of a person. They contradict them. They divert it. So they, what will happen is you might say, listen, I was uncomfortable that this issue came up in our relationship, or, you know, you you coming late to this family dinner was really disruptive, and it was, you know, it was really disrespectful to the host. And then they'll turn it around and say, oh yeah, well, remember that time you were late to something?
Exactly.
So they won't ever be able to have a conversation. All of that is gaslighting. So what it does is it minimizes the other person's experience. And it's really one of the most classical tools of the narcissist. And it's very destabilizing. You know, people don't like it. It's upsetting, but they don't quite get it. And after a while, they find themselves, I always say to people, you know, you're in a narcissistic relationship when you feel the need to start recording conversations.
Yes,
and when people start doing that, people are like, I'm going to record this conversation, because it's as though they think they'll play it back to the person. The narcissist is just going to, actually what they're going to do is they're going to get mad at you for recording conversation.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And then they, but people often do it as like, am I losing my mind? And sometimes
yes.
they'll go back and listen to the recording. But as when the day you feel like you need to start recording conversations in the relationship is the day to get out of that relationship.
Because
that person's not listening to you. So why are you staying in it?
Right. And I agree. And in this work relationship, like I felt like my brain was being scrambled. I didn't know if I was coming or I was going. I didn't know what was going on.
Right.
I kept questioning my reality. And I even called meetings with this physician and I sat him down and I said, because I had uncovered other things that were going on there and I had done reports. And I told him, I was like, listen, I'm going to your chief and I'm going to have a conversation about all of this. And he just sat across from me and started to shake. His hands started to shake. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you know, what do you have to say about this? And he had nothing to say. But then he
right.
proceeded to make me the scapegoat, make me the bad one. And so my good friend at the time was an attorney and he had covered this facility. He's like, get out, you know,
mm-hmm.
Because it was just so dangerous. And I got out of there. And the funny thing is this individual, this doctor lives a block away from me. And when I had gotten the job, he saw it on my CV. I told him, I was like, hey, so where do you live? And he's like, oh, I live in Burbank. And I was like, oh, me too. And he goes, you do? I go, didn't you see it on my CV? It's on the top, you know? And he literally lives a block away from me. And we have a park that is in the middle of our community. And I would see him at the park. And as of late, I think I saw him about a year or two ago with his children. And he saw me and he ran the other way. But it was so serendipitous. I was just like, are you serious? You really think you can get away with this? Like, and he would just continue, you know, it's almost like there's no moral compass. It's like, what is going on in their brain?
Yeah. No, I mean, what's going on in their brain is that they are completely unaware of the experience of the other. I mean, while narcissists have the cognitive, they have the intellectual ability for empathy. So in other words, they could hear a story and they'll know that that's a sad story. They're actually not able to one-on-one, you know, understand the experience of another or show any interest in it. By and large, narcissists view other people as objects to get needs met. Well, those needs might be something at work, validation, help with something, money, status, power, sex, any of those things. When they don't have a need for the person, they don't interact with them. So in that way, it's almost like a can opener. I don't talk to my can opener or care what my can opener thinks. And then when I pick it up, I'm glad it works. I don't even interact with it and I put it away. So the can opener is only interesting when it can do something for me. That's how narcissists are with people. And so that utter lack of empathy, and they have a very strong sense of defensiveness, because anything they feel is going to threaten, because they're so insecure, anything that threatens them, you know, someone calling them out, is almost over-perceived as a threat, and so they overreact.
That's, yes, I think that's an excellent account. And going back to the objectifying, I see that in the dating world a lot of the times, where with the app dating and everything, people are like, oh, I just want A, B, and C. And they're trying to have this person fit into their life instead of just seeing them as an individual and seeing them as an actual human being. They're objectifying them. And I started noticing that a lot. And with things. And I was like, oh, because I'm a rather unique individual. I'm a little bit different. I'm not your typical, hey, I go to work and, you know, I'm just the nurse and, you know, and then I come home and watch Netflix. That's not my life. So, I have a very different type of life. So certain men have a problem, understanding that. So then I say, oh yeah, you just want an object. Can you attest to that in the dating world and what's going on with the app dating and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, app dating is tough because app dating is based on one thing and one thing only, which is appearance, right? Yes. I mean, you're right swiping on someone because you like their picture, not yes. because there's some, you know, some depth or anything like that. And if there is depth that follows up, great. But what it does is it makes it a volume business. You can swipe on many, many people, and it does make it very superficial. Now, listen, any social psychologist out there could argue with me successfully that, well, attraction does originally start on a physical basis. It does. It does. But the problem is the online spaces are so prone to deception. You put on an overly altered a photograph of yourself. You can say all kinds of interests you have that may or may not be true, you know? And so, and then by the time a person unpacks it, I think many people are lonely. I mean, I think, and I think that's a big epidemic in our country
yes.
right now. A lot
yes.
of people are lonely because it is very hard to create deep, meaningful connections with people. It takes time. Too many people are relying too much on online spaces. I think
yes.
online spaces have their place, and I'm not going to sit here in 2018 and say you need to be a Luddite, but I think it's a balancing act. And at the end of the day, the research is very clear. There's no substitute for being in a room with a human being. There's really not. And a living, breathing human being, not through a screen, not even through FaceTime or something like that.
It's very true.
We're losing those experiences. We're breaking away from that sense of community. There is a sense of loneliness. And I think when people are that lonely, they will look at, you know, any port in a storm kind of a thing. So it's really, really complicated. And I think that what happens is that they, in the online spaces, where, listen, again, I'm not going to tell anyone they don't work. Plenty of people have met lovely
yes.
partners and spouses through OkCupid and through all kinds of dating sites. They, clearly, if in the right hands, they can work. And that's part of why I want people to understand narcissism, because you could meet a lovely person online and you could also meet a raging narcissist online.
Yes.
I think you're more likely to meet a raging narcissist online than you are in person, because if a person's standing in a bar and really acting like an ass and you're seeing them straight up, you'll be like, oh, that person seems like really like a grandiose jerk. And you,
right.
and so in other words, you left swipe them in your mind because you're seeing them live, you know? So whereas you don't get that opportunity. And for some people, they're sort of in for a penny, in for a pound. Once they start getting in, they kind of see it through. And it's that,
yes.
that's my concern with it. But I mean, ultimately, anytime you're talking about superficiality, narcissists are always going to win. They love stuff. They'll wear the best labels. They'll be best put together. They'll have fantastic bodies. They'll be really well put together. I mean, narcissists, for example, are much more likely to get cosmetic procedures and whatnot because they really focus on their external. They do absolutely no work on their internal. So like I view myself as like an internal cosmetic surgeon. I help people pretty up their inside. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Whereas right now we know that it's billions of dollars that are put into cosmetic transformation, and that's because people are insecure. That's what they, I mean,
right.
the entire cosmetic surgery and cosmetic treatment industry preys upon insecurity, and narcissists do too. So when somebody's saying, aren't you so pretty, and that's a lot of people's vulnerability, people fall for it. It doesn't cost much to tell someone they're pretty. And so it's a great way to suck someone in. And so there's a real insincerity. And the fact of the matter is online spaces tend to be a bit more insecure. And that's why they play well in that space. And they do objectify people. So when a woman is dating a man and the man keeps saying, hey baby, I need you to wear high heels in front of my friends. I mean, and you know what?
Hey, I read a whole blog about
that. And be honest with yourself. If this is a transactional relationship, and your guy is putting 20 grand a month in your bank account, you can call it anything you want. I'm not going to judge, but just be aware that there's a price to that.
Right,
not only is
price.
It's human degradation and there's money. But listen, some people might say, if I can earn 20 grand a month by walking around in high heels, I know a lot of dudes that would sign up for that. So
yes.
you just need to know. But if that woman whose guy is telling her, I'm giving you all these gifts, I'm buying you all these bags, I'm going to get you a car, and I expect you to walk around in high heels, understand that all of that stuff comes with a price. Don't turn
exactly.
around and expect that guy to be Mr. Empathic and Mr. Sweetheart. That's
or,
not
or to listen to your dreams and your wishes and everything.
No, not going to happen.
Right. And what I've noticed too with me, because I am on the apps and dating as well, and I also have, there's another part of me called Notoriously Single Girl, and I write a blog about that and about dating and about myself and dating myself and just doing the selfie date and stuff. what I started to delete is these guys who love bomb and who are like, you're so beautiful, you're so pretty, you're so this, you're so that. I immediately delete them because I think I've retrained my brain enough to make me nauseous when someone love bombs me. And it just does nothing but turn me off now because it's just all that superficiality. So it's kind of an interesting world to where you don't even know what is the normal dating paradigm. I know you go over like the old rules, like where, oh, let the guy chase you, you know, and it's almost no. like the cartoons that we would see with the Pepe Le Pew, who was chasing around a cat who is not even in his species, you know, so this is what men have been trained to do.
They have been trained to do it. I mean, there is this, but the issue is though, we are not, this is not Neanderthal times. Like, you know, the whole idea of it has to be a chase. In fact, in my own podcast, we recently did an episode on that. No, a woman can be interested in a man, or a woman can be interested in a woman, or a man can be interested in a man and approach them appropriately. You know,
exactly.
It doesn't have to be a big chase. And I think the idea of a chase already implies a power dynamic that's problematic. Listen, if you need your guy to be that guy, understand it's going to come with other problems. And I think the person wants Mr. Prince Charming, Mr. Chase Me, Mr. Has a lot of money, Mr. Going to spoil me. They want all that, but then they want him to be a gentle sweetheart. You're not going to get it all in one guy.
It's not going to happen.
And so, yeah. And I do think that entire, for me, that, like I said, if I succeeded at what I set out to do, I'd get more and more young women stopping themselves from getting into relationships with narcissists. Like I said, once they do something like get married or have a kid with them, or it escalates into violence, I've seen too many of these stories end tragically.
Yes.
And so
game over.
I do believe that you've got to get, you know, it's about the gatekeeping and, or at least know what you're getting into. You want to have a 3-month little fling with a guy who flies you to Hawaii and drives you around in his sports car and spoils you for a little while? Put a shelf life on it. Like,
yeah.
Put a date in your calendar 6 months ahead of time. Say, this is the day I'm going to break up with him. Here's the problem. Narcissists tend to be very vindictive. And
yes,
so if you do last in that long time, they don't be surprised if they turn around and give you a bill or torture you or call you out on social media. That's why I tell people, don't get in the first place. Ladies,
right.
You know, grow up and buy your own damn ticket to Hawaii. You know, like, enough. Like, this whole idea of the transactional relationship is what the narcissists get into. They win people over that way. And I think people need to understand that there's a price to that. And the reason I'm referring to women in this is because women are the ones more likely to do it. It's how women have been socialized.
Right.
Sure, some men do it, but it's less likely. But it's really, and people will go on their various social media platforms, look at this beautiful necklace he gave me, look at this beautiful vacation
right,
we're on.
Right.
They tell, and everyone feels like, well, why doesn't my relationship look like that? Maybe your relationship doesn't look like that because it's healthy. That's why.
Excellent, excellent point. One thing as we wrap up here that I want to bring up is in the nursing world, they've had, someone did this research in the 1980s where they found that there was a lot of bullying. And they coined this term, nurses eat their young. And I've been a nurse now for probably 22 years or so. And I've heard this. It's like a song that keeps playing. And anytime you would go and report someone for bullying or, hey, this is not going right. Or, you know, like I've had managers that said, well, that's just what happened. Nurses eat their young. Or when new student nurses are going in and they're getting bullied by whoever's training them or their mentors, this is the song they sing of nurses eat their young. Now, from my own personal research and really looking into this, and, you know, there's so many theories on bullying and what happens with nurses and research that has been done. I think it accounts to one thing that goes back into your book is really looking at what you're familiar with and what you grew up with.
Yeah.
Because I think that people who maybe grew up in a narcissistic home are more prone to bullying. I was listening to NPR. I forget when, but they had this research study where women who went into the military who maybe had a very abusive childhood were the ones who were picked on more, were the ones who were abused, and were the ones who suffered sexual abuse as well.
Interesting.
And so I don't know where that study is or what it is, but I remember hearing it on the radio, and that kind of clicked with me to start looking into why certain people get bullied more than others. You know, and all it comes down to boundaries, like you write in your book.
Right. Right. It does come down to boundaries, but it also comes down to being aware of what happened to you. I think a lot of people grow up in narcissistic families and they're not even aware that's what happened to them. They don't have a word for it. They think like, oh, well, you know, I don't know. I had tough parents, or my parents weren't warm, or they, you know, my parents had to work hard, so they didn't have time for us. Kids and even adult children are expert at crafting narratives around their parents. At the end of the day, somebody signs up to be a parent, they should be a decent one, which means being empathic towards your child and loving and connected and paying attention to them. And if they didn't do that for you, they screwed up. You know, because I've known people who live in dire poverty who brought that to their children. And I know people who have more money than anyone you could imagine, and they can't. So exactly. It has nothing to do with money and resources. I know people are stressed and working 3 jobs, and yet they find that time to be present with their kids. And the kids are able to say, well, mom's here. She's here. She's on. You know, so people know the difference. But what ends up happening is that familiarity of having to constantly win your parents over, manage your parents, yes, validate your parents, all of that becomes a pattern. And it becomes a pattern that's so deeply entrenched and leaves a person with such a sense of insecurity that when they meet a narcissist, it's not unusual for them to say, wow, I have so much chemistry with this guy. Mm-hmm. Chemistry is a dangerous word. It's not chemistry, it's familiarity. When somebody brings back that old nostalgia of being ignored or verbally abused by your mother, you call that chemistry. Because there's a chase, just like you had to chase your mother or chase your father to get their attention. Now you got to chase this person, get this guy to answer your text. That weird, sadly and creepily nostalgic feeling of, wow, this feels like childhood. That's not chemistry. It's just reigniting and re-triggering those old childhood scripts that you haven't worked through. When it happens to a child, I tell anyone, if your parents drop the ball, it's not your
exactly.
It's to let that down. And you then decide what you want to do with these parents. Do you want to keep them in your life or not? That's your call. You know, and what you feel comfortable with. So I think that that's why it's a setup, because having parents who are narcissistic leaves the person insecure. Insecure people, right. Interestingly, somewhat insecure people are the ultimate prey for pathologically insecure people, and those are the narcissists. So yes, it's like they almost like go in there and they just sort of take them over. Because let's face it, a healthy, well put together, confident person in many cases may say, listen, you're not treating me well, I'm going to walk away. But I do want to say there's a sidebar to that. Sometimes people who come from very, very, very happy families, everyone was sweet and loving and happy, and they had great big family time, and isn't this great? They often fall for narcissists too, because they're all about forgiveness and second chances, and yes, everyone gets along and everyone has a good part to them. And that Pollyanna-ishness that can come from those families often makes them bait. I always say that it's like an immunization. You just want a little bit of dysfunction to come out of your childhood. Not so much that you're pathologically insecure, and not so little that you can't tell a bad guy from a good guy. Just enough, you know, and then you become a little bit more savvy and you can see this stuff coming from a mile away.
It's very true. I mean, I know I'm still working on it, you know, but I've done a ton of work on my internal self, like you said. And even when it started, I remember I started noticing people's patterns. I started to take a step back and even watching their mannerisms. Like I remember at work, there was this one woman who every time, and it was all women, and I could see she was just trying to be the alpha of the group. And every time she'd make a point, she'd touch someone. And so everyone that worked together hated that, but no one would ever tell her. So I told her one day, I was like, hey, you know, I don't want you to touch me when you make a point. And she immediately was like, well, that's just what I do. You know, and so I was like, but it's not right. You know, and so it ensued.
And so, but then you have this idea of that's what's just what they do. I actually, and more than a few narcissists will say, this is just how I am.
Yes,
that's actually a really good insight. And you know what? Then you have the choice to say, okay, I don't want a relationship with this person. I don't
exactly
want to. And if you have to keep working with them, you keep your distance. It's almost like saying, well,
exactly,
listen, this car only comes in red. Then if you don't want a red car, don't buy that car. You're not going to be able to paint it a different color. So when a person owns up to it, and basically a person's behavior shows you that's who they are, because even if you maybe communicate with them once or twice and they don't change, that's who they are. You right. are not going to be the one to change
it. To change them, exactly. And it's like a lot of people will get into relationships. Well, maybe I'll be the one to change them, or the savior mentality, which you write about in your book. And that, it's like, no, just say no, you know, which I've learned because I get that all the time. Oh, maybe you can teach me how to do this. And I was like, sure, for a price, you know, because I do consulting as well. And people are like, oh, I want to do what you're doing. And I would get calls and I was like, you know what, this is, it is my work now and it's exhausting. And it took me a lot to say, I need to charge mm-hmm. before that. I will give mm-hmm. you 15 minutes free and stuff like that. One thing that I want to touch upon real quick is in going back to the dating thing, when I would give people, like they'd want to talk on the phone. And so I'd give them a good 15 minutes. And it's interesting, they would immediately start with a sad story about themselves. And so mm-hmm. And you talk about that in your book, like they're, it's almost like a trauma mm-hmm. bonding, like they're trying to hook you. Mm-hmm. Oh, look at me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, my house burnt down when I was a kid, or my mother left me, or whatever the mm-hmm. story is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you
then you're stuck,
that a little bit?
Right. Yeah. Then you're stuck. Right. Wow. This is a poor guy whose house burned down. Wow. This is a poor guy who, like, gosh, people were really mean to him. Listen, those things may be true. It's not your job to fix them, because that history, and it's not unusual for people who are narcissistic, sociopathic, or psychopathic to come from really invalidating, narcissistic, or even abusive homes. That can happen, all right? And I'm sad for them. But if that in adulthood turns into them lacking empathy and being really grandiose or just being downright mean, I'm sad those bad things happen to them, and I hope they get into therapy. It's not your job as a partner to fix that. So I would say, sadly, here, if the person's leading with their sob stories, it feels more like a manipulation or yes. a need for mental health services. And you may even want to say, you might want to get some help.
Yeah.
Because that's what, if that feels more like, I'm going to hook you in, and now you know this vulnerability, you won't walk away. And I know that sounds really mean-spirited on my part, but I can't tell you how many people I know that have stayed in relationships for over a decade because they're like, God, he had such a rough start. I feel like I'm just one more person who's leaving him. I'm like, you're not the one who raised him, and the
exactly.
other people who've left him since probably left for a reason. So, you know, I mean, I think what I'm trying to do is give people permission to not be abused.
Not engage.
Like, you know, there's no special place. Not engage them. I am sorry that anyone has suffered at any time of their life. And I'm sorry that maybe that has resulted in why they are so unempathic. Like I said, I hope they get the help they need. But mm-hmm. you staying in a relationship with them is not that help.
And I totally agree. Like with these people, like I say, like if the guy goes, oh, I want to talk to you on the phone, I'm like, okay, I'll give them 15 minutes. And if it's that, if there's no communication, and it's funny, when I start talking about myself, they shut down. They're like, oh, you know, so I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, obviously, you know, thank you very much. But in next, and I could tell now that I see the patterns, and I'm pretty good with, like, you know, and I'm very careful, and I take a step back and really watch that, because I've gotten myself into some doozies and stuff. But and for my own mental health, it's like, I don't want to be around these people. I live a very calm, happy life. Now, so can these narcissists change? I think we went over that. There is some research. I sent you that article where scientists were saying that the narcissist can kind of empathize.
Kind of empathize is not helpful in a relationship. Okay. And I think that's the problem. What happens in a research lab is very different than what happens in real life. So in a research study, they may actually see a shift in empathy, but that might be just a few points on some empathy test. Does that translate into real life? When your kid's waking up in the middle of the night sick, you got another kid to care for, your husband says, I won't help, or somebody you've been dating keeps texting other women and doesn't understand that's hurting you, not so sure that's going to change. Remember, the narcissist does have intact cognitive empathy. They can cry at a movie, but when that same scene happens in their real life, they won't respond to it warmly. They won't even account for the other person's feelings. So they can understand it, like any of us can understand anything, but they don't participate in it. So do I think they can change? Probably not enough to make them a healthy participant in a meaningful, rich relationship. That said, I hear all the time, and I work with narcissistic clients all the time, these are people who say, I really, really do want to get it better. And what will happen is you might get them a little better in the empathy space, but they continue to be very rageful. or you might get them a little better in the empathy space, but they continue to be really entitled or really jealous. No matter what, it's not going to be an easy ride with this person. So you have to decide how much you can live with. Can they not change at all? No, I think if they want to change, they can, but under stress, under conditions of frustration or disappointment, almost invariably, that narcissist will always return to how they always are. Because as soon as they feel like their self-esteem or their sense of self is being threatened, it's always going to go back to square zero. That's just how they are. That's how all of us are. You know, under stress, that's what I always say. See someone under stress, because that's really the measure of who they are. If you don't like what you see, get out.
Excellent point. And this has been an amazing discussion. I've loved this so much. And thank you for coming on, Dr.
Thank you.
And
my pleasure.
Where can we get your book from? And can you tell us about your website? If I'm sure your classes are packed at Cal State LA.
They are. But I think the students, just they don't care. They just want to get out. I don't think the students give a damn about what I do. But in terms of my book, you can find it at drromani.com, which is drromani.com. And on the website are links to lots of videos and lots of content, and as well as a link to my book. The book is called Should I Stay or Should I Go? Surviving a Relationship with a Narcissist. It's available on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble. You can ask your local bookseller to get it. You can also get it on your iPad, on your Kindle, or as an audiobook via Audible. So there's lots of different ways to get it. And it has, you know, it's a lot of people, even if it's not a narcissistic partner, but it's a narcissistic family member, some of the tips in that will help. And
like I said, the tips are great even for work.
Yeah, I think so. I think it does.
Put it to the situation.
And in early 2019, I have a new book coming out. But in that book, I really do more directly take on what if my parents are a narcissist? What if my child is a narcissist? What if my cousin is a narcissist? Like, how to deal those? Because all of those have slightly different demands, and as well as a re-review of what happens if your partner's a narcissist. And some of the issues are, why are we seeing more and more narcissists in the world? Right. Why that's happening? And really, it's a survival manual, how to keep yourself sane in the midst of this. So that's coming out, like I said.
And why do you think this is happening, real quick? Because I don't think we went over
that. Because we reward it.
Donald Trump, because of what?
Yeah, we reward it. We reward narcissism. Narcissists, as a rule, make more money. They're more successful. They head most companies. They're all over politics. They run the media. So remember when narcissism fosters and festers and does better under conditions of insecurity. We're in some of the most insecure times we've ever been in. People can't afford homes. People are worried about their health. People are worried about their health insurance. The world has become very superficial. How come she has that bag? How come he has that car? And so under conditions of insecurity, the narcissists tend to win, but we reward them. When you lack empathy, you can really run a huge company well, because you're willing to fire anyone. You're willing to throw people under the bus. The more you're willing to throw people under the bus in capitalism, the more money you're going to make. And because of that, because we actually like looking at these big bullies and these, almost it's entertaining, they're getting a lot of power these days. And what that's doing is sending a message to everyone, even kids, that behave this way and you will go farther. And I hate to tell you, in terms of material success or power, the narcissists are always going to have more success. And in fact, there's a lot of research showing that people who are higher in agreeableness or warmth or friendliness or empathy, they tend to make less money. There's your answer.
It's very interesting. You also have a podcast.
I'm sorry?
I
have a podcast. It's called Sexual Disorientation. And I highly advise people who are interested in this topic not only to tune into our podcast, you can get it on iTunes or anywhere you can get podcasts, but also toss us an email at sexualdisorientation@gmail.com. Okay, that's sexualdisorientation@gmail.com. If you send us an email, we build that into our content. So if you have more specific questions on narcissism or a narcissistic relationship, send them in. I'll tackle them on the podcast. So I do have a podcast. Again, lots of videos out there, this book, and follow our website. There's always more content coming up.
Excellent.
And we're also going to start doing seminars. And the seminar, we do Instagram Lives about once a week. So if you have questions, you can follow me on Instagram, on Twitter, on Facebook, at Dr. Romani, DrRamani. So I believe we're having another Instagram Live on Thursday, August the 16th. But we do them about once a week. We announce them on Instagram, and then you can type your questions in and we will get to them. So that's a great way to get real time information and learn from other people's questions. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
This was a lot of fun. And thank you to nurses and hypochondriacs out there. Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, and on Twitter. And nurses who listen to this episode can get one continuing education unit. Just click on the link, fill out the survey, and you get your one CE. And till next time, thank you.